From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Susan Rice bows out, the fiscal cliff looms, North Korea goes long range, and the stars come out for Sandy. Susan Rice, the president's favorite, withdraws from consideration for Secretary of State, says she didn't want to be a distraction.
I made the decision that it was the best thing for our country, for the American people, that I not continue to be considered by the president for nomination as Secretary of State.
Fiscal cliff talks go nowhere visible. Yesterday, Speaker of the House John Boehner was eager to blame the White House.
Here we are at the 11th hour, and the president still isn't serious about dealing with this issue right here. It's this issue, spending.
In North Korea, official excitement over the successful test launch of a long-range missile. Here was very excited state television with the news. And New Jersey natives Bruce Springsteen and Jon Bon Jovi sang Who Says You Can't Go Home at the big concert for Sandy Relief in New York City. And the money rolled in. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Davis of USA Today, Jack Tapper of ABC News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Korean missiles, right to work, Susan Rice, fiscal cliff. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us this hour from Washington, Susan Davis, chief congressional correspondent for USA Today. Susan, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you here. Also with us from Washington, Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC News, author of The Outpost, an untold story of American valor, the Afghan war story there. Jake Tapper, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Susan, and Jake.
All right. Where to begin here? Jake, I'll come to you with Susan Rice and her withdrawal. Was it inevitable? Did the White House, they must have come close to saying we're going to go on the mat, to the mat with this. The president certainly spoke very strongly in her favor in recent days and weeks.
He did. That's true, especially when initially challenged. And by all accounts, she was at one point the leading contender. But sources tell me that President Obama was, for a long time, fairly torn between the two choices he had, Senator John Kerry, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, or Susan Rice. And in recent days, he had said he had made a comment that was not as impassioned mm-hmm. as his first comment in that press conference after the election. And I'm told that the president was leaning towards Kerry, and it looked as though he was going to go with John Kerry for any number of reasons, starting with the ultimate reason that he thought Senator Kerry would be a better Secretary of State. That said, he had not yet made a decision, and Rice, in the view of many Democrats, took one for the team by just withdrawing and saying that she didn't want to continue this partisan fight.
Here she was explaining that, taking it for the team. This is with Brian Williams on Rock Center, the U.N. ambassador, saying she took herself out of consideration because she didn't want the distraction.
The first several months of a second-term president's agenda is really the opportunity to get the crucial things done. We're talking about comprehensive immigration reform, balanced deficit reduction, job creation. That's what matters. And to the extent that my nomination could have delayed or distracted or deflected or made even some of these priorities impossible to achieve, I didn't want that.
Susan Davis, you're covering Capitol Hill. Pick apart the Senate resistance here. Was it because she was tough on John McCain when he was running on his Iraq policy, when he was running for president against Barack Obama? Was it because if John Kerry goes to be Secretary of State, there's an opening in the Senate, could end up being a Republican? How do you read this resistance? Or did they just not think Susan Rice was cut out for this particular job?
Well, she's right that it would have been a fight if she were to be nominated. Part of it is John McCain. John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte have been sort of this trifecta of opposition to Susan Rice on the Hill. And they had made it very clear that they were going to fight her nomination if the president had done that. While that was important, I think what really started to sort of change the way people were looking at her was part of it had seemed partisan, that this was a Republican-Democratic divide. Mm. But then when you had Susan Collins, who's a Republican senator from Maine, viewed as sort of a moderate and not someone that was looking at this through as harsh a partisan lens, when senators like Susan Collins started coming forward and saying, you know, I have doubts – And in the current situation, I'm not sure I could support her. Someone like that almost sent more of a signal that this was not going to happen on the Hill. And if it was, it was going to be a protracted fight.
Jack Beatty, how do you read this? Here's a comment. Lots of stuff coming in on the web. Here's a listener who says, I hope the panel will tackle the larger meaning of Rice's withdrawal in the context of the White House decision to forego charges against anybody at HSBC. This is almost $2 billion in fines this week against the big bank that laundered money, apparently, for Mexican drug cartels in Iran and maybe Saudi banks with ties to terrorists. This listener says the president is picking up where he left off in the first term with an absence of backbone. What do you say, Jack?
Well, I can see that argument. Is this a sign of weakness? This is a person he was passionately committed to. He did make that earnest avowal. You know, if you have trouble, come after me, Senator McCain and Senator Graham.
Though, in fairness, that was about her Benghazi report, not about a nomination to the Secretary of State role, which she never formally was.
That's right. And you know, just Benghazi. I mean, the main question about that is the question that was asked of the president during one of the debates by a member of the audience. Mr. President, who was it that made the decision not to accede to the request of people in Benghazi for more security? Who made that decision?
Yeah.
We still don't know. Next week, Secretary Clinton is going to the Hill to brief Congress about that. There's supposed to be a report coming out about that.
But it sure wasn't Susan Rice. She's nowhere in that chain of command.
She had nothing to do with that at all. Nothing whatsoever. And so this whole thing has a character of almost substitution. You know, they weren't going after the State Department. They weren't going after Secretary Clinton. I don't know whether there's anything to go after. They went after this symbolic target.
Jake, you were filling in that weekend. You were on ABC This Week. You're the guy who put the question to Susan Rice here. Had you expected to see Hillary Clinton in that hot seat on that day, Jake, instead of Susan Rice?
No, I hadn't expected to see Secretary Clinton. It's really difficult to book her for a Sunday show. Mm-hmm. She's reluctant to do it. She had just been traveling and was exhausted, was emotionally spent because of the death of Chris Stevens and the three others. And then also, apparently, she was sick. Well, you know, I think all of us mm-hmm. who were doing Sunday shows that Sunday wanted Secretary Clinton because she ultimately was the one responsible for the safety and security of Ambassador Stevens, not Ambassador Rice, who is, you know, UN ambassador, certainly an important position, but not one in charge of answering security requests. But they put her forward, and that was who the administration was put forward. I mean, it's funny because when President Obama defiantly told McCain and Graham and the other Republican senators taking issue with Rice to go after him instead of Susan Rice,
he said, "You got a problem? Talk to me."
She had nothing to do with it. She had nothing to do with it. Well, then why did they put her out on the Sunday shows? Basically, she was there to regurgitate talking points given to her from the intelligence community, and they obviously proved to be erroneous at the end of the day.
And, of course, this was part of the complaint made that it was a kind of political characterization to defend the White House in the heat of the campaign. This was Senator Collins' point when she came out of that meeting, not very great meeting, I guess, of Rice and senators. Robert in Burlington, Vermont is calling. Robert, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I want to compare falsehoods made by two different women who are surnamed Rice.
Okay.
On one hand, you have a woman who reads from a script supplied by somebody else. No decision is made by this falsehood. No U.S. personnel die as a result. On the other hand, we have a woman who identifies a false threat. That was a threat of a mushroom cloud.
Condoleezza Rice talking about Iraq back in the run-up to the big war there.
Yep, and this, she does this at a time when the nation is quite tender after 9/11.
Yep.
In doing so, along with a lot of other falsehoods, just as in her falsehood,
yep,
this is actually used as the factual basis to take the nation into war,
yes,
an unnecessary war in which 6,000 or 5,000 Americans are killed. And which woman named Rice becomes Secretary of State?
Yeah, Condoleezza does. Susan does not. Jack, there's a fair point from some perspective of distance in time there from our listener.
Yeah, absolutely.
Susan, sorry?
I would just say that that is an argument that Democrats made throughout this argument. When, and obviously, she was never nominated, but they drew the parallel between Condoleezza Rice offering misleading information leading up to the war in Iraq. I would also note that two people that voted for Condoleezza Rice were Barack Obama and John Kerry in the Senate. And there's this question of, you know, does the president have a prerogative to have who he wants to serve in his cabinet? Yeah. An argument that John McCain had made at the time as well. But, you know, times change.
Jack, talk about asymmetric treatment, though.
Oh, yes. My gosh. I mean, and of course, at different times and so on. What both cases have in common, of course, is errant information from the CIA. One fatally wrong and one sort of wrong after the fact and evolving. But, I mean, they have that common property. And I think U.S. Secretaries of State and National Security Advisors simply have to take bushels full of salt any representation from that agency about an existing state of
facts. Especially
fact.
If they might have in mind becoming Secretary of State. Jake Tapper, what about it? Was she handed just a real bum script by the CIA? And beyond that, Jake, you were in the questioner's seat there. Did you hear her politically tweaking what she may have been given in Barack Obama's favor?
Well, I mean, look, from the very beginning, I was being told from different people in government, not as political people, that what happened at Benghazi seemed very different from what was happening in Cairo and other places because of the video. So their adherence to their insistence that it was part of the video, I found curious from the very beginning.
Well, on the other hand, NBC's Chuck Todd says Susan Rice, a victim of conservative advocacy media. Many interpretations, but she's out. Senator John Kerry, maybe next up. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Susan Rice out of consideration for Secretary of State. Withdrawn. A North Korean missile goes long. Michigan passes right-to-work legislation in the cradle of the American labor movement. More cliff talks there. Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for USA Today, is with us. Jake Tapper, White House correspondent for ABC News, author of The Outpost, is here. And Jack Beatty, Hillary Clinton's name not in the Benghazi target directly, as Susan Rice was. But, of course, people are thinking a lot about her. She's headed out before the next term begins. Here she was just for a second here. We'll get to that cliff. But here was Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, talking with Barbara Walters on Wednesday, saying she currently has no intention of running for president in 2016. You heard Clinton first, then Walters pressing her.
Right now, I have no intention of running. I just want to... I want to make a contribution. I always feel that's who I am and what I want to do.
Will it be political?
I don't think so. I think it'll be philanthropic. It might be academic. It might be business. I mean, there's a lot of things. All doors are open, which is a wonderful opportunity.
Susan Davis, what's the talk on Capitol Hill about Hillary Clinton at this point looking forward?
I think people I talk to, I think they believe her when she says she doesn't know if she's going to run. I also think that a lot of people on Capitol Hill, if they had to place a $50 bet, would probably lean it towards the side that she's probably going to get in 2016. But who knows? I mean, the other person on Capitol Hill that is in that same situation on the other side is Paul Ryan. Part of the a lot of the chatter inside the Capitol is actually more focused on Ryan these days because he's in the building.
Is he positioning in the fiscal cliff talks for a run to your eye, Susan?
It's possible. We'll see. I think part of it depends on what happens and how he votes and what he says about it is going to be seen as sort of, people are going to read into that as sort of how he's positioning himself, particularly if he votes against whatever comes out of it because it's not conservative enough. I think some people would read that as a sign that he's trying to hold on to his mantle as sort of the conservative leader of the party.
Jake Tapper, quickly, how do you see Hillary Clinton's road ahead from your end of Pennsylvania Avenue?
Well, it is 4 years away, which is, you know, several lifetimes in the world of politics. I don't think she wants to close any doors. I know a lot of people around her are getting the band back together and being prepared if she does run. And I think that a lot of other nominees or other possible candidates, rather, will depend on and are looking to see what she will do. For instance, it's tough for there to be a case for Martin O'Malley, the governor of Maryland, or Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, if Clinton is in the race. And then, of course, there's the Joe Biden factor. I don't know what she will think in 2 years. I'll be watching and what she does and hearing her public comments, reading her memoir when it comes out. If it's scathing and score-settling, mm-hmm. then I'll know she's not running.
Right.
And if it's diplomatic and benign and warm pudding, then I'll think maybe she is.
On her way, Mona in Boston. Mona, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Tom. I was, to me, it's very obvious that the fact that Rice just repeated what the intelligence told her, and it wasn't really her job. She was just in talk show covering. The fact that the Republicans are going after her so vigorously and they insist on Kerry, to me it seems it's very obvious it's all about the balance of the Senate. And they're hoping that they get the put back Scott Brown in the seat of Kerry. So my question for the panelists is, if you think as Kerry or a senator was not the candidate, do you, let's say it was the next person in line was a governor, a potential candidate,
yeah.
do you think they would go after Rice as hard as they did?
Pure political calculus question there, Susan. There's Senator John Kerry, senior senator from the state of Massachusetts. If he goes to state, obviously there's a seat open. There's been a strong contender there in Scott Brown. He didn't win that. It went to Elizabeth Warren just now, but he still stands there having just come through a campaign. It was fairly close. How strong the political calculation, just looking for advantage in the Senate headcount?
I don't think people like John McCain were motivated to pursue this fight over the Senate seat, but it does add a certain amount of political intrigue to what happens next. If John Kerry is nominated, and there seems to be a strong argument that he will be, we're going to have another special election in Massachusetts. And Scott Brown, who just lost his reelection, is primed to run again and cost Democrats a seat. They don't, Democrats in Massachusetts at the moment don't have a very deep bench of candidates. I think that's part of the reason why they had a hard time finding someone to run against Scott Brown and obviously settled on Elizabeth Warren, who won by a significant margin. But this is going to be a great political story. If John Kerry leaves, Massachusetts will have, I believe it's third Senate race in as many years. From the special election to that elected Scott Brown, his reelection, and then again. I think the state's a little exhausted by it.
And if that seat should go Republican, who knows? But if it should, where would that leave the head count in the Senate between the parties, Susan?
In the next Congress, Democrats will control 55 seats. So if they were to lose that seat, they would still have a 54-seat majority.
So,
Tom, a little interesting note about this. The reason why the governor of Massachusetts does not appoint a replacement is because the Massachusetts legislature in 2004, anticipating a John Kerry presidential win, did not want Governor Mitt Romney to have the power to name his replacement. So they changed the law. Talk about the law of unintended consequences.
The backbite of history there. We got to go to that fiscal cliff. It's where everything seems to stand. This was Wednesday. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor telling reporters that Republican members of Congress would stand their ground, even if it meant working through Christmas.
The president seems to be walking us ever so slowly towards the cliff. We've said we're committed to staying here. We're going to stay here right up until Christmas Eve, throughout the time and period before the new year, because we want to make sure that we resolve this in an acceptable way for the American people.
Susan Davis, I don't know if we can all take this, but is this really going to go right through Christmas? Is anything happening under the covers here that you can detect, Susan?
I think it's going to go right up to the line. I expect and am planning on Congress to be here the week between Christmas and New Year's, based at least on what we know and the progress that they've made so far. And it's not much. You know, there's been offers traded back and forth. The conversations are ongoing. But there is a huge and persistent divide between President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner on how you can reach what they're calling a big deal to reduce the deficit over the next 10 years. I think they will get something done, but I don't think it's going to be grand, and I don't think it's going to be much of a bargain.
I mean, there's John Boehner. Who knows exactly what he wants to do, but there's speculation that he doesn't feel he can bring his party along or doesn't want to take the risk until he's reelected as Speaker of the House January 3rd. Here's Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen of Maryland speaking to that point.
I'm getting increasingly concerned that one of the reasons the Speaker is deciding to, I think, string out these discussions is that he wants to wait till January 3rd when the election for Speaker takes place.
What do you say, Jack? A speaker who can't deliver if he wants to? This looks like the dynamic in the summer of 2011.
Exactly, and that does look like the scenario. You know, just to step back from this a second, Tom, I'm struck by the lack of economic imagination in the administration's position. Look at the economy. What does it need? Stimulus. Now, the CBO says that this raising taxes on the top 2% would cost 200,000 jobs. Not a lot of jobs, some jobs. Now, we know the taxes on the rich are theology to the Republicans. Let's imagine the president went to them and said, all right, this is theology. We won't make you be apostates. We're going to go along with that. And in return, I want emergency unemployment extended for another 2 years. That means people are getting, you know, precious lifeline to keep them alive. Although, you know, 2 million people will lose benefits starting January 1. I want a modest stimulus, and I want an agreement putting off any debt ceiling trouble. What do you say? And we can talk about tax reform next year and dealing with those problems. Let's have another year of economic growth. I mean, it would be objectively in his interest to have a more vibrant economy.
Well, and true, Jack, true, but we've got lots of listeners online on both sides of this, but plenty saying, backbone, Mr. President, backbone.
Yeah, how about effectual? How about being effectual? How about getting what you want? And what you want, it seems to me, is a vibrant economy, at least for that next year, and put off these things into the future. He seems to be fixated on, I ran on this. This is what I want. Well, you know, election promises are not about what's best for the economy, necessarily.
Jake, what do you say? Any chance in heck that the president's going to fold his cards on that high-end tax hike?
I doubt it. I think... I've been saying for weeks that I think that we're going to go over the cliff for any number of reasons, not the least of which is Boehner's problem with his caucus, the fact that he views, you know, his life experience has been shaped to a degree by the fact that he was stripped of his leadership post in the 90s during the failed coup against then Speaker Newt Gingrich. So this is somebody who really has his eye on the Republican caucus, and you know he has Majority Leader Nero behind him, then also you have the issue of the fact that President Obama is, you know, he's going to have a struggle bringing Democrats on boards for any major cuts to entitlement spending, those social welfare programs. I think that that the four of us right now could probably, you know, do something and come up with a plan that, you know, 75% of the American people would support. But ultimately, that's not the issue. And they're so far apart right now I think it's possible that we'll go over the cliff, or what people close to the negotiations tell me is more likely than that, is some sort of quick fix that deals with some of the issues, such as a short-term plan to deal with the automatic spending cuts from the last time there was a failure to come up with deficit reduction, the so-called sequester. There's $1.2 trillion in spending cuts that are scheduled to start to take effect. They could pay that down, come up with a few billion dollars in cuts.
But I thought there's no way the president wanted to give up his leverage and then face the debt ceiling coming right up in, what is it, February, where the power dynamic may shift, Jake.
I don't think that he thinks that. I think that there is a strong argument to be made that the Republicans will never be in a better bargaining position than they're in right now. Right now, they could exact a lot from President Obama. They could. I really legitimately think this after talking to...
Republicans could exact a lot? I thought he had the whip hand here, was the consensus.
I think President Obama feels that because the public is with him, that he has to get these tax rate increases on the wealthiest two tax brackets. But I think if Republicans are serious about deficit reduction, spending cuts, entitlement reform, they could get a lot out of him, I think, now. Mm-hmm. But after January 1st, all the taxes go up. And I don't know what leverage they think they have. The White House just feels like, in terms of this whole debt ceiling thing, they're not going to play that game anymore, they say. We're just not going to do it. And they will let get the business community to lobby Republicans in Congress and say, look, this is not a game. It's never been done like this before. We did it last year. We're not doing it again. And I mean, we'll see if they're bluffing, but I feel like I've had a lot of off-the-record conversations with these people and background conversations, and, you know, they feel like Republicans can get stuff from them now that they're not going to be able to get after the taxes automatically go up.
So down to the wire we go, I guess. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi saying, well, again and again this week, that raising the Medicare eligibility age, unacceptable. Here she was yesterday.
Don't even think about raising the Medicare age. We are not throwing America's seniors over the cliff to give a tax cut for the wealthiest people in America.
So there's a little party background noise for the president as well. Rebecca in Bellbuckle, Tennessee. Rebecca, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Love these political stories, and I just want to say I agree with Nancy Pelosi on that issue because I'm a nurse. I've taken care of a lot of seniors. And that is unacceptable. These people need the benefits. I live in Bellbuckle for 20 years. I have a son named Jared that goes to college. It's his third year. And the reason this is so important to me is because I care about the country. And as a registered nurse, we make ends meet, but I can't afford to send him through college completely on my own. He's working. I normally work. I recently am switching jobs as a nurse, but we're both working hard to get him through college, and it's only because of Pell Grants that I can do it. And I'm involved with the Action.org, and last week five of us women from Tennessee went to the Capitol. We spoke with Corker, our representative,
Senator,
office,
yep.
And we did a little mini rally in front of Boehner's office. Because this is a huge issue for America, and we don't want the president to shift positions to give to the Republicans that don't understand how important these programs are for small business, for veterans,
for your son in college, Rebecca. We've got it. Thanks for calling, Susan Davis. I mean, it is a long list of things that get cut, including, you know, there's Pell Grant stuff on the chopping block here too, right?
Yeah, the reason why this debate is, I think, interesting is, and I see it a lot even with in our own readers, is that I really think that often when you talk about budget fights in Washington, I don't necessarily think it often engages the average American. But this fight, in a very real sense, basically affects every American household. One where if you collect a paycheck, this fight in Washington is going to affect your life, particularly if they, in a worst-case scenario where they go over the cliff and do nothing about it. Everybody will feel that in their first paycheck of 2013. And I think it's starting to intensify outside the Beltway. I think people are starting to get it. They're starting to be more concerned about it. Like your caller said, you know, a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck in this country. And I think you're starting to see part of the reason why I think they will get something done is I do think a lot of lawmakers like Senator Corker are really starting to hear it increasingly from their constituents back home.
Jack, what are you feeling in your bones where we're headed here with the president's instincts? The assumptions Jake Tapper's laying out, the pressure Susan's talking about.
Well, it looks bad. And, you know, what it really looks like is that 2010 Tea Party election was historic, partly, as Richard McGregor points out in the Financial Times today, because it coincided with the census, with the decennial census, allowing the newly elected Republican legislators all over the country to gerrymander districts. And, you know, in the last election, the Democrats got about a million more votes in the House than the Republicans. They only got eight more seats out of it. In a state like North Carolina, they won more than half the votes, but fewer than a third of the seats. These districts now, Republican districts, are safe against national tides, or anything less than a tsunami. And the result is the Republicans don't feel they have to change. If they can appeal to that sector of their, you know, that theological sector that wants no taxes, they'll be reelected.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a masked gunman identified as 22-year-old Jacob Tyler Roberts shot up a mall in Portland, Oregon. Two dead, one seriously wounded. GameStop employee Mark Hake was there.
As soon as I heard more shots happen, I knew at that point we needed to lock up and get everybody in the back of the store.
Zero Dark Thirty, the soon-to-be-released movie about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, is raising again the discussion of American torture.
I'm not your friend. I'm not going to help you. I'm going to break you. Any questions?
Seen from the movie trailer there. Watch that to make a splash when it comes. And big musicians gone this week. The great Ravi Shankar at 92. And the beloved Mexican-American star Jenny Rivera killed in a plane crash in Mexico. One of her biggest hits in the U.S. Inolvidable or Unforgettable.
Inolvidable. Si me dicen mis ex amores. Por tu nada y sin que te ofendas. Tengo cariños que sí son mejores.
We're looking at a week in the news. A North Korean missile goes long. Michigan goes right to work. More Cliff Talks. Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC News, is with us, author of The Outpost about Afghanistan and the war there. Susan Davis is here, chief congressional correspondent for USA Today, and our own Jack Beatty's here. Sam's calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I was hoping your esteemed guests might be able to help out my son and his fellow 10th graders at Lincoln Center Regional High School.
Okay.
They were wondering, they were hearing about the HSBC banking thing and how they're getting fined like close to $2 billion, and they're trying to figure out how come no one has gone to jail. And they've been also studying in their class about a similar crisis in the late 80s, the SNL crisis, where I think over 1,100 cases were brought and 800 people went to jail. And they've been reading about it, and they read in the New York Times that, well, they can't take the bank down because it might hurt the economy. But then they've also been studying about how serious the drug wars are, and then they learned that HSBC was laundering money for the biggest Mexican drug cartels.
And for Iran is the allegation, and for Saudi banks linked to terrorist organizations.
And then the terrorist organizations, they were wondering if the war on terror is really serious or it was just a whole big thing to get us into Iraq. So they have a lot of questions.
We've got it, Sam. How does a 13-year-old take this one on board? Jake Tapper, walk in here with us. I mean, it sounds like a lot of money, $1.92 billion in fines for HSBC, but they made some kind of profit, like, I don't know, was it $30 billion in the last quarter or year anyway? The administration has been kind of under the gun, people saying, why didn't you go further if the offenses were this serious? What's the answer to that, Jake?
It's tough to explain because it's tough to justify. What I've been asking this question and looking into it for a series of reports I've been working on for a while. One of the reasons is that, well, I'll tell you what they say. The prosecutors say a lot of these cases are difficult to prove because, first of all, as is often said in Washington, the crime isn't what's illegal, it's what's legal.
You mean prove in court of law. Yeah, okay.
And also there's a lot of shadiness that's permitted and it's difficult to prove a lot of these things. But I would say there are those who believe, including, you know, reputable people such as Neil Barofsky, the former Inspector General for the Troubled Assets Relief Program, who believe that the Obama administration, like the Bush administration before it, is too cozy with big banks, that too many of the people who work for the administration come from that world, whether it's the White House Chief of Staff Jack Lew from Citigroup, Tim Geithner, obviously, when he was head of the New York Fed, had a lot of close relationships with people there. His chief of staff is a former lobbyist for Goldman Sachs. And there are a lot of people like the Sheila Bairs and Neil Barofsky's of the world who think, of course, they're not going after these financial crimes. They come from that world, and they see that world through that prism, which is these big banks must be as big and powerful and strong as they should be. And these are good people and trying to do a good thing.
But I mean, aren't there lines here somewhere? I mean, Jack, look at this lineup. Iran with its nuclear program that these sanctions were intended to try and head off. The drug war, which we've invested so many years and lives in. The war on terror, which we've gone to war all over the place. And then a bank does it and it's okay.
It looks like, what is the line now, too big to indict. And that gets back to and even to the foundational issue with this administration, and that is breaking up these banks. You know, there were only, I think, 26 votes in the Senate for that. Only the liberals voted for it. It remains, it seems to me, the best answer to this sort of question. If this bank were in pieces, if this bank was not too big to indict, maybe somebody would be indicted. But, you know, so long as you have these mega institutions with their mega shadow of influence over the economy, they are immune. They're immune to bankruptcy. They're immune to criminality or even putative criminality. And at the root of it is their size and the Dodd-Frank reforms didn't touch that, and that remains a threat.
Sending somebody to jail doesn't take down the bank. It takes somebody out of the bank's management.
Well, I understand, but then you hear the people saying, well, what would happen over here? I mean, you'd have people thrown out of work. You'd have, you know...
You'd have one guy, or maybe five in jail.
It's hard to make the argument, but I see that once you leave them so big... That's a structural problem.
I just don't see how that applies in this case. It's not a killer fine. They can afford it. If somebody went to jail, that doesn't hurt their bottom line necessarily. I want to turn to Michigan and the right-to-work legislation there. This got pushed through in a hurry. Here was Michigan Governor Rick Snyder telling NBC's Andrea Mitchell on Tuesday that the state's new right-to-work law was about giving workers more choice and boosting the economy.
I think it's a good thing. It's about being pro-worker. It's about giving freedom of choice to workers. And then secondly, as was mentioned in the earlier report, it's about economic development. We will get more and better jobs coming to Michigan because we're going to be more competitive.
It's a good thing, says the governor. Not everybody's so sure. Here was one Michigan Democrat, Representative Douglas Geese, saying right-to-work laws would scale back a century of progress. He compared what he sees as a coming conflict over this to the Battle of the Overpass, major labor clash back in 1937.
This was dropped on December 6th, and now we sit here 5 days later, and we're going to pass something that will undo 100 years of labor relations. And there will be blood. There will be repercussions. We will relive the Battle of the Overpass.
There will be blood. Watch out. Let's hear from our listeners. Rich in Southington, Connecticut. Rich, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Greetings to you and your guest.
Thank you.
I first know that I'm an educator lifelong who's taught in both a unionized public school system and in parochial school.
Okay, what do you see?
And the unemployment rate, the average in right-to-work states is 6.9% right now. The unemployment rate in closed shop states like Michigan was is 8.7%. Interesting to me is 26,000 kids missed school the other day because unionized teachers called in sick so they could run to Lansing and protest legislation making Michigan a right-to-work state. Those teachers are not among Michigan's 9.3 unemployed. It's up from 9.1 to 9.3. And I'd argue they have no real concern for the working people who are, and that they place their personal politics above real concern for the kids that they're being paid to educate.
So you welcome right to work in Michigan because why, Rich? You think you agree with the governor? Healthier economy will come here?
I believe that, especially for people right now unemployed, who, when we will, get the unemployment rate down both nationally and Michigan, when we do, those then working, now unemployed people will be paying through the nose for taxes. Because Michigan has incredibly unfunded pension liabilities negotiated by public sector unions in the state.
Rich, we've got it. You're saying, let's go this way. Let's get another right here, and we'll put them back to back. Mike in Watertown, New York. Thanks for calling, Mike. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
That right to work out there is frightening, and you can tell your previous caller about his employment percentages. Go talk to the people in Las Vegas and ask them out in Nevada how they feel about it, because there's no people working out there. That right to work is going to give those employers the right to walk away from the pension programs, the right to walk away from the collectively bargained benefits.
I'm not sure that's technically true, Mike. You think just down the road that's where this leads?
Oh, absolutely down the road. Historically, look at what they've done down in South Carolina and down in the southern United States with in the right to work state.
I can't vouch for Rich's unemployment numbers state by state right off the top of my head here, but what about his argument that it leads to a more to lower unemployment?
Pardon?
What about his argument that you get more jobs with right to work?
I don't believe you do. Nevada's got the highest unemployment rate in the nation right now.
Yeah.
And they're a right-to-work state.
There's Mike frightened by right-to-work. Jack, what do you see?
Well, you know, I'm looking at a study from the Economic Policy Institute that says that 7 of the 10 highest unemployment states have right-to-work laws, 7 of 10. So mm-hmm. that's to Rich's point. There seems to be, at least here, an opposite correlation. They also point out that these laws, on average, tend to cost workers, both union and non-worker union, $1,500 a year. And they look at the issue of, you know, does this create more jobs? They point to Oklahoma, which did this, I think, around year 2000. And Oklahoma, their manufacturing sector actually shrank after right to work. It didn't grow. So claims on all sorts of sides. What is clear, though, is that even people who don't belong to unions have a stake in the union wage. Economists have been pointing out for decades it puts upward pressure on all wages. And so it's in the interests of all Americans, really, to have more unions. And, you know, there are those two lines on the charts that show the decline of the American middle class and the decline of unions. They run together. If they're not causal, it's a correlation such as science rarely sees. And, you know, the only way, it seems to me, for people to rise up in this country, especially in the service industries, is through collective bargaining, through making their voice count at that bargaining
table. Well, unions knocking on the door of, what is it, McDonald's right now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jake, Susan, we've got to take it abroad here. This North Korean missile, they've tried and tried. They've failed, but this time they didn't. Three-stage missile, long range, out over the Yellow Sea, the Pacific, down toward the Philippines. A long shot here. They've got fissile material enough, we're told, to create 12 nuclear weapons, and now they're going long. Jake, you know, I was thinking back to the George W. Bush administration where stuff like this got the White House all up in arms. What about the Obama White House looking at what's happened with North Korean missiles this week?
Well, they've downplayed it, but this obviously is a very serious development. I think one of the things that's most of concern is the cooperation between the Iranians and the North Koreans, and then the potential of North Korea to export this technology one way or the other, whether it's through their own missile delivery system or by allowing terrorists to, you know, have access to, you know, enriched uranium and nuclear material. It's a very serious development. I remember early on in the Obama administration when the first missile went off. When the first missile was launched and it was not particularly successful, this one appears to have been a lot more successful.
Are people thinking of a threat to the you know, territory of the United States here? Never mind more immediate neighbors.
I don't think it's that level yet of sophistication, but it's certainly an achievement that is upsetting to those who are in charge of it. And combined with what's going on in Iran and the inability of the United States to convince the Iranian regime to pursue a different path when it comes to its nuclear weapon program, it's hard to say that the Obama approach as of right now has been successful with either of these two rogue nations.
On another front, Syria, where it looks like the Assad regime is under heavy pressure this week. On Tuesday, President Obama said the U.S. would officially recognize the Syrian rebels as legitimate government of the nation. Talking with Barbara Walters here.
We've made a decision that the Syrian opposition coalition is now inclusive enough, is reflective and representative enough of the Syrian population that we consider them the legitimate representative of the Syrian people in opposition to the Assad regime. And so we will provide them recognition. And obviously with that recognition comes responsibilities on the part of that coalition.
all kinds of flux in the Middle East. Egypt voting on a new constitution, beginning its vote tomorrow. News just in as we speak that Israel's hardline foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, has resigned after being charged with fraud and breach of trust there. That's interesting. And then, Susan Davis, this news out of the Defense Department here that there will be two Patriot missile batteries in Turkey and 400 U.S. troops not far, so far from the Syrian border to man them. Where does it look like the United States is headed with the Syrian conflict, Susan?
That's a great question. I think in some ways we can close where we started, where it reinvigorates the importance of the Secretary of State right now and why that was such a big issue this week. I mean, regardless of who President Obama nominates, John Kerry otherwise, all of these scenarios that you just laid out are incredibly serious foreign policy issues that the government is facing right now. And that the idea that they could have a fight over the politics of the person just seemed very untenable at a time when it does appear that we could use someone very influential in all of these conflicts abroad.
400 American troops on the Syrian border or near it, Jake. Is the White House willing to be bitten by that conflict? It certainly stayed, kept its distance so far.
I personally am skeptical that the U.S. would involve itself militarily, but they're certainly taking actions that if I were Bashar al-Assad, I would be concerned. I mean, I think there are a few things going on here. One is the U.S. doing everything it can to help the rebels, without actually sending troops in or sending U.S. aircraft overhead.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a reluctance to send in ground troops, absolutely.
Showing NATO solidarity there with member state Turkey next door to Syria. So many refugees there and a very tense border. Interesting week, and here we go, even closer to the fiscal cliff, more interesting days to come. Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC News, thank you so much for joining us today, Jake.
Thank you.
Susan Davis, chief congressional correspondent for USA Today, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, on Monday, we talk with Ai Weiwei, China's most famous living artist and a very big and fascinating critic of the Chinese government, joins us live from Beijing. Don't miss that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.